Thank you to Red Eye, the Photography Network, for partnering with us to produce Season 3 of the Photo Ethics Podcast. Red Eye is a not-for-profit organization with a strong ethical focus, offering support and opportunities to help you advance your photography and your career. Find out more at redeye.org.uk. Welcome to Season 3 of the Photo Ethics Podcast. I'm your host, Savannah Dodd, and I'm the founder of the Photography Ethics Center. Each week, I'll be talking with an accomplished photographer about the ethics of their practice. Today, in episode number 9, we'll be talking with Anthony Lavera about collaborative representation. Anthony Lavera is an Australian artist, writer, and educator based in London. His photographic work has been exhibited widely in galleries, public spaces, and festivals, including Tate Liverpool, National Portrait Gallery London, Belfast Exposed, and Photo Ireland. His writing has appeared in a range of publications, including Photography and Culture, Visual Studies, Photo Works, Source, and Photographies. Anthony is Associate Professor of Photography at the Center for Arts, Memory, and Communities at Coventry University. He's editor of Photography for Whom, a periodical about socially engaged photography, and chair of the Education Committee at the Royal Photographic Society. Could we start with you just telling us a little bit about the kind of work that you do?
Yeah, so the way that I work is often described as participatory, collaborative, or socially engaged. That is, I'm really interested in using photography in a way where I'm able to involve or invite participants to co-create the work that I'm making with and about them. And yeah, over the sort of past 20 years or so, I've worked with a range of people and communities, people that have experiences of mental health issues, people with addiction problems, individuals who have experienced homelessness, or children that come from lower socioeconomic households, and people who identify as LGBTQ+.
What does collaboration look like? Does it always look the same, or are there different ways that you use collaboration in your work?
It's a really interesting question, especially the way you phrased it, the way that collaboration looks. And I'm not sure that collaboration looks like anything in particular. For me, you know, collaboration is a process. It's a conversation. It's a dialogue. And certainly in various sorts of strands of my work, I have different kind of methods or approaches that I will use to invite the participants to work with me. And then there are other projects and strands to my work where, you know, the kind of process of collaboration is very much one which unfolds as that dialogue with participants continues. But certainly I think that, you know, for me, a collaborative practice is one where the elements of co-creation are foregrounded, and finding ways to represent that process of co-creation is kind of woven into the work or the texts that kind of surround or accompany the work.
So I guess it's in that way very transparent about the process, because it sort of shows the viewer as well what the process looked like.
I hope so. I mean, I think that, you know, that it's always impossible to kind of effectively relay that process to an audience without that audience actually being present in the room. And one of the things that I'm also aware of is that as the artist, for me to only do the relaying of or describing of that process, it's in a sense undermining the kind of attempt to equalize or retilt that power dynamic. And so, you know, certainly with projects like Let Us Eat Cake and Not Going Shopping, you know, using kind of blog spaces and writings by participants, I've really tried to find ways to invite participants to also contribute to that kind of describing of process, that recording of that journey that we've taken through the creation of the work.
You touched there a little bit on the power dynamics and the power imbalance. And I know that a lot of times we in photography talk about collaborative methods as being a way of mitigating the imbalance. Can you speak to that a little bit? And to what extent does that work? To what extent doesn't that work? And what is the power imbalance as well?
Yeah, you're right. I think often collaboration is kind of put forward as a sell for the problems of representation, in particular the kind of methods used in documentary and photojournalism. But I'm not sure that the problems of representation can ever be fully solved, actually. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that collaboration, what it might be able to offer is a more nuanced view into the experiences of the people being represented. You know, one of the things about collaborative practices or collaboration is that it's best thought of it in terms of a scale. And so on the one hand, one might think of collaboration as being a kind of an exchange whereby the subject or participant is afforded or invited to make relatively passive contributions in terms of how they pose, how they dress, where the location of the image might be, the gesture that they may make in the photograph in front of the camera. And then perhaps on the other side of that scale, you know, a collaborative practice may be one where the participant is invited into a really kind of active contribution of co-creation of the finished work, which is then kind of presented to audiences. And I don't know that there's necessarily kind of hard and fast rules around a value judgment that we can make about one being better than the other. But I think there are many ways that collaboration can take form. But I am really kind of wary of stating that collaboration is the answer to the problems of representation.
Could you maybe talk about some of the ethical dilemmas that you've encountered in your work and how you've dealt with them?
Yeah, that's a good question. Before I begin to talk about that, I just want to pick up on a train of thought from your previous question about collaboration. When I first began to recognize that the way that I work is collaborative, I became really interested in the dictionary definition of collaboration. And I've often referred to it in my public speaking and writing. And the dictionary definition of collaboration states united labor, but it also speaks of traitorous cooperation with the enemy. And I think what's really kind of fascinating about this sort of double-edged definition is it's, in a sense, a distillation of the kind of ethical dilemmas of photographic representation, and particularly in collaborative practice, that one may have a desire to work with the subject as an active participant in the creation of their work. But at the same time, there are kinds of power imbalances and problems that are really kind of thorny and possibly impossible to solve. You know, I think in terms of a specific ethical dilemma that I've encountered, now I've been thinking about this in the kind of lead up to our conversation today. It's not that I haven't faced ethical dilemmas, but I don't know that it's necessarily been a sort of punctuation. I think that one of the things about the way that I work and what I've come to recognize about my sort of relationship to photography is that I'm constantly, not second guessing, but just kind of rethinking. I'm constantly rethinking. And, you know, I think that in doing so, I've kind of learned a lot about the way that I work. And what I try to do is kind of bring that learning into future collaborations or into the ongoing practice. Well, to give you an example, let's talk a little bit more specifically. Around 2002, I began working with people experiencing homelessness. After a few years, I was invited by a curator for the public art program on the London Underground to present some of this work in an exhibition across 12 stations in zones 1 and 2 in central London. And, you know, I did as much as I thought I could possibly do to enable the participants to fully comprehend what it was that this exhibition would be like. So I had prototypes of the posters created, which I brought into the workshop space. I took the participants to the specific locations where images of them, the assisted self-portraits that we had co-created, would be presented. And I had worked with intellectual property copyright lawyers to produce a set of plain speaking consent forms and license forms for participants to enable me to use these self-portraits and the photographs that they created. And everyone that I invited had said yes. And so we went ahead with the exhibition. And then as soon as the exhibition went up, one participant was really unhappy with the exhibition. She didn't speak of a specific thing that she wanted to be changed other than to say that she wanted her posters, her portrait, her photographs to be taken down. And I was really, really gutted. I was so disappointed, not because the exhibition had to be altered, but because I couldn't work out what I could have done differently. But we took the work down, and a short time later, she changed her mind and asked to be included back in the exhibition. We didn't have the resources, the budget to kind of do that, and unfortunately we weren't able to do that. But what I learned in that time was that this idea of consent is a dialogue, and just because a participant or a subject may say yes, it doesn't preclude them from having the capacity or right to say no and to withdraw that consent, regardless of whatever reason they may have for the withdrawal of that consent. And so, yeah, I don't know if that sort of answers your question.
No, absolutely. I think that's a really interesting example. And there's a lot in that that we could unpack. But I also want to say, I guess, to your previous point, that, you know, ethics and these ethical decisions are so embedded in your practice. I think that's true of everybody. But I think that people aren't maybe always as aware of it. Because I think that every decision we make when we're taking and sharing photographs, all of those decisions, as much as they're aesthetic, are also ethical. And so I think it's great to hear, you know, that that's also how you think of it. It's a bit of a sanity check for me, you know, that yes, other people are thinking of ethics in that sort of quite embedded, fundamental way that everything you're doing has that ethical dimension.
Well, I think it does. And I think it's really difficult, the idea or the notion that there is one set of ethics that can be applied to all situations. I'm not sure that that is the case. I think that one of the things that I've learned is that the time I spend before I use any equipment is the most important time on a project. To give you two examples of that, one, to take the current project that I've been working on since 2018, I've been working with people experiencing homelessness in Birmingham, commissioned by a wonderful organization called Grain Projects, and working in collaboration with Cypher Fireside. Cypher Fireside is one of the main sort of support services for people experiencing homelessness in Birmingham. And I spent around a year volunteering in the kitchen of this service, helping to make breakfasts and lunches and serving people food, and just spending time volunteering in the organization, getting to know the staff of the service and also the clients of the service as well. And that not only enabled me to develop a rapport and to get to know people, but it also enabled me to ask questions of the people that I met about the plans that I had. When would be a good time for me to come in and work with people? You know, how can I go about it? Are there particular forums or networks or individuals that I should approach or present my plans to? What time of the day? What day of the week? Just really kind of practical kind of surveying of people. And not least of which, you know, should I even be doing this here? And it's sort of through that kind of groundwork, if you like, that I'm able to really gauge a way forward. And in doing so, to be sure about how I'm shaping the invitation that I'm presenting to participants to get involved in the practice. Another example is from a different project, which is called In Conversation. In Conversation was commissioned by the Wellcome Collection to create work with non-binary and trans men around the UK to explore their experiences of masculinity at different times of their life. And when I first received this invitation, you know, I really had to kind of just think to myself, God, am I the best person to be doing this? I'm not trans. I don't identify as non-binary. And although I identify as queer and, you know, lesbian, gay, bi, transsexual, you know, the whole kind of spectrum of that acronym is often kind of clumped together. I see myself as an ally to trans people, but my life experience is so vastly different. So just sort of really thinking through that question, I immediately reached out to two participants who do identify as trans men from a previous project called Not Going Shopping. And I just opened up that conversation with them about my right, my capacity to be able to do this work, and also how I could go about it. And really, you know, I kind of asked them, invited them to be critical friends, to kind of just have these sort of conversations with me, to also look over any texts that I was crafting to be able to disseminate through the networks of support and services and social organizations for trans and non-binary people, and to really just help me think through how I went about it. And, you know, I think it's a process of conversation, I suppose, that I really try to sort of take part in so that I can learn as I go.
Absolutely. And I guess all of these things that you're describing are quite time intensive, right? So I can imagine time is a important resource in your work. How much time do most of your projects take? I mean, I'm sure it varies, especially when you're working with maybe a commissioned project. How do you approach that conversation as well about needing time?
Yeah, you know, I think there's often a preconception in socially engaged practice that long-term is good and short-term is bad. I'm not sure that is the case. Certainly, you know, there have been projects which have lasted, you know, several years. As I mentioned, the work I'm currently doing in Birmingham was first initiated in 2018. Of course, the pandemic threw us a bit of a curveball, but it didn't prevent me from continuing to work with participants over that time, albeit I had to sort of change the way that I work to be able to work remotely and online and through post and telephone and things like that. But, you know, I think what's more important is not necessarily the duration that one has to work within, but rather is the sort of clarity of the invitation and the sharing of information with the participants. Oh, actually, with the work I mentioned in conversation just a short time ago, made with trans men and non-binary people looking at masculinity, I had a pretty short period of time to make it, and I think it was maybe like about 2 or 3 months. Pretty short time, you know, in comparison to other projects, which have been a year or several years. So that was another reason, really, that I felt like I really needed to kind of draw upon critical friends as a resource to help me kind of really refine and shape what that invitation is. I think it's really important to be really kind of clear about the invitation to take part in a socially engaged practice, which isn't to say that one needs to be prescriptive or overly directive of what it is that we want them to do, but rather it's about sort of sharing the information that you have. You know, I have this length of time. I'm commissioned by these organizations. There's a set of resources that we have access to. You know, the expectation of the work to be culminating in a particular form, whether it's exhibition or publication or whatever. And to kind of share that information and to kind of begin a conversation with participants and or critical friends to be able to work out how to move forward, how to kind of respond to those different kinds of boundaries or, you know, expectations.
I think that's a really interesting point. And longer term projects, I guess, require a lot of buy-in from the participants. And I could envision a situation in which it actually becomes maybe burdensome or an imposition on people to be maintaining that over a long period of time. Have you ever found that in your own work?
Well, yes and no. I say that because actually, one of the things that a longer period of time can actually offer, and particularly for people that have other priorities, is that it enables people to dip in and out or to join at a time when they're able to. So for the work I'm making in Birmingham, I'm still currently working with some of the participants that I met the very first day I stepped foot in Cypher Fireside. There are others that I met last week that are now taking part. And some of those participants that I've been working with since 2018 have stepped away and then come back. Others have carried on a weekly, monthly basis. I think the thing to remember for me is that it's not about someone taking part in a project. More importantly, it's about a relationship with the person and kind of just keeping the value of what you're doing in check, particularly when I'm working with people who are experiencing homelessness. I'm going to be pretty low down on the list of priorities of things that are important for them to try and do or achieve or take into consideration. It's sort of factoring into one's own expectation of the framework of what you're doing, factoring in that kind of flexibility so that participants can take part in whatever level of commitment they're able to kind of offer. And ultimately, it's a relationship with a person. That's absolutely key. It's about remembering that the relationship is the work, really.
Absolutely. And have you always done collaborative work, or did you pivot into that? And if so, why?
Yeah, so I began working with people experiencing homelessness in 2002. And I think really that was the beginning of my kind of collaborative practice, really. And it came about because I was invited by someone who worked for the homelessness charity Crisis to come along and take pictures at their annual shelter event, Crisis at Christmas. And in a very sort of well-meaning way, they said, you know, come along and take pictures. It's great. There'll be over 1,000 people there. photographers love it. And I felt really uncomfortable about this idea that I would step into this space and photograph people. You know, I was really kind of aware of the critical writing on documentary photography through my own photographic education, and at the sort of very heart of the debates around the sort of representation in documentary and photojournalism is the way in which poverty and homelessness are represented. And I never thought I wanted to work with people experiencing homelessness. And I turned that invitation down. And a few months later, I found myself doing some consultation work for Kodak on their single-use cameras. And I found myself in a really great position to be able to access a large number of disposable cameras and processing vouchers. And I went back to Crisis and suggested that I could come along to the following Crisis at Christmas and volunteer and invite people to meet with me in a workshop activity project that Crisis were about to set up. It's called Crisis Skylights. And now there are many Crisis Skylights around the country, but at this time, around 2002, 2003, they were just about to open the very first one in Spitalfields in London. And so I did that. I went along to the following Crisis at Christmas. I helped out. I worked in the kitchens. I helped people with computers. I organized a karaoke session. I gave out clothing, footwear, blankets, things like this. I just did the things that volunteers do. And I had little pieces of paper printed up with the message that said, you know, if you're interested in photography, come and meet Anthony. And every Friday between 2 and 5 at the new Crisis Skylight. And I thought I'd get maybe just a few people come along, because many of the people I met have very complex and chaotic situations in their lives that they were contending with. But actually, in that very first meeting, there were over 90 people, and it was kind of overwhelming, but thrilling. And, you know, people came with all kinds of questions right off the bat. Why are you doing this? What's in it for me? What will I get out of this? Are you going to make money out of this? How can I make money out of this? What is this for? You know, I didn't have all these questions figured out. I mean, I really was just rather naively thinking, God, it'd be really interesting to see what people experiencing homelessness would take pictures of. You know, they've long been the subject of photography projects about homelessness, but what would happen if they became the author of those projects or co-author of those projects? And I just answered those questions as honestly and openly as I possibly could, and just, you know, kind of encouraged people that if they were interested, they could take the cameras away and photograph the things they're interested in. I'd get them developed and, you know, give them back to them. If people would allow me to, I'd love to be able to hang on to those pictures and to use them in exhibition and publication, but they didn't have to if they didn't want to. And really, that was the kind of beginnings of my collaborative practice. But when I think about collaboration and the role that collaboration has played in my practice, I can also sort of now, in retrospect, think even further back. When I was 14, 15, I had an uncle, or have an uncle, who was working as a private detective or a private investigator. And he lent me one of his cameras and several lenses. And a teacher at school gave me and my best friend some darkroom equipment. And so we kind of used all this equipment to teach ourselves photography and how to print black and white photographs in sort of makeshift darkrooms in our family household's bathrooms. And I really enjoyed it. And my friend Peter and I thought we were so good at it that we thought we could make money out of it. And so we put an ad in our local newspaper to advertise for photography workshops. And we'd have people, mostly adults, coming around expecting to be taught photography skills, how to operate 35mm film cameras and how to develop black and white film and print photographs in the darkroom. They expected to be taught by other adults, and actually they were taught by these two 14-year-old kids. And when I think about that, and that was when I really began to identify as a photographer, and I can see now that my earliest experiences of photography have been about enabling other people's knowledge of photography and generating enthusiasm for photography. And I think that's really been a kind of an undercurrent that has stayed with me to today. When I left secondary school, or high school as it's called in Australia, and had the opportunity to go to university, I enrolled with a major of English literature and a minor in writing. And I took an elective unit in photography, or photo media it was called. And I was taught by these brilliant documentary photographers, including Max Pam and Kevin Ballantyne and Norm Leslie. And it was like a light bulb moment was kind of switched on for me. Not only the kind of making of photographs, but the writing about photography. And it really kind of inspired me. And I switched all of my degree studies around and began to study a major in photography with a minor in writing. And kind of the way that I was using photography at that time, I was very much interested in fashion photography and portraiture. And I began to make a little money in those fields as well, and began to develop a practice. And I now think about working in that way. It's a very collaborative enterprise. You have the photography, you have assistants, you have a makeup artist, a stylist, a model, possibly an art director. You have a whole team of people working collectively on the creation of the finished image. And so when I think about those sort of earlier experiences, both in my teenage years and in my sort of early 20s, leaving university and beginning to work in fashion and portraiture, I think the kind of seeds were sown for me to then fully take up collaboration in the way that I have now.
That's really so interesting to, yeah, go back and sort of find sort of the mustard seed of collaboration was planted quite early. I love that story about 14-year-old you. That's brilliant. Can I ask as well, you know, you touched on this briefly there when you're talking about the Christmas event and the first workshop and people asking about money. How do you handle the ethics of financial gain from collaborative work? I think that this is something that, you know, a lot of times if there's like a documentary photo series on a social issue, there's a lot of questions about, well, do we donate a percentage back to a relevant charity, or what does that look like? I'm sure you've thought about this as well in your own practice.
Yeah, I have. And it would be a misconception to think that I've made a lot of money with my practice, because I haven't. And certainly in the earlier period of the work that I'm talking about, you know, in the sort of early 2000s, I was really struggling to make ends meet. And in terms of funding the work, you know, I had part-time jobs in photo processing labs. I worked as a key worker in homeless centres. I did all kinds of things to support my photography project. And also I would apply for funding as well, you know, to the Arts Council, to various kinds of foundations and trusts on a sort of project-by-project basis to just enable me to progress the work that began with that first donation from Kodak. So in many respects, the money that I was kind of acquiring or kind of accessing was about enabling the resourcing of the practice. And as I've kind of gotten a bit older, and, you know, I work in a similar sort of way, but I also have a full-time job as an academic at Coventry University in a research centre called the Centre for Arts, Memory and Communities. And, you know, I'm able to kind of access research funding, and I'm also, you know, continuing to access various kinds of support from trust foundations and also, you know, be commissioned by photography organizations. I think it's being transparent about the sort of resourcing of the projects is a key priority for me with the participants. I don't have the capacity to pay participants to take part, and I've thought about this a lot. When I say I don't have the capacity, what I mean is that often the budgets that I'm invited to work with or apply to use, there hasn't been a kind of budget line, if you like, to pay participants to take part. And, you know, for a long time, my thinking was that would that sort of effectively incentivize people to take part? And would that, in some senses, kind of, I don't know, undermine the ethics of the practice? But in some respects, I can see an argument for actually, it would be a way to effectively provide a more ethical approach. I don't know, question mark. Some projects I've been able to pay participants for various contributions, whether it's public talks or whether it's a particular contribution. But in doing so, I've had to be really kind of mindful that often the participants that I work with are on benefits, and any kind of formal payments to them would effectively interrupt or adversely affect their capacity to continue to receive those benefits, or certainly in the sort of shorter term. So thinking creatively about how one does that, whether that's through gift vouchers or whether that's, you know, cash in hand. And then occasionally be invited to do things. So the Photographers Gallery invited me to facilitate a public talk, and I invited a participant from Not Going Shopping to co-present that with me, and they were able to be paid a speaker fee in the way that I was. That's one example. There have been many like that. And look, I think it's a really good, important question. And perhaps this is an example of an ethical dilemma. It is an example of an ethical dilemma that I'm constantly thinking about and trying to sort of move through. I think it would be a mistake to think, certainly at this point in my practice that I am somehow making a lot of money and really skimming from this practice, because I'm not. Another example would be when I was invited to have some work in a group exhibition at the London Art Fair, which is called Gravitas, and it was curated by Christiane Monarchy. And we included a collaborative portrait from Not Going Shopping in the show, and also produced a new newspaper, a community newspaper, as part of that body of work. And we gave the community newspaper free throughout the fair and in the kind of immediate area. And the work, when I was asked about putting a price tag on it, because although this is a kind of a keynote exhibition by an invited curator, as opposed to a gallery presenting the work of artists, it is the context of an art fair, and they expect, you know, price tags to be put on things. And that was kind of weird. You know, I don't have gallery representation. I don't have a commercial side to my practice. But what we did is the funds from any sales were donated to Mermaids UK, which is a charity for young trans people and their families, which kind of, in effect, really kind of supported what Not Going Shopping is about, which is a representation of queer people.
Absolutely. I mean, it is such a complicated question, you know, to think about money. And I think that those are some really thoughtful examples of working your way through that. I think that that'll be really useful for people to hear, you know, how you've navigated that, and maybe some inspiration for people, you know, trying to navigate that right now in their own practice. What advice would you give someone who was wanting to pursue a career maybe similar to yours, or career in collaborative photography?
There's a few points that come to mind. I think it's really important to keep your good intentions in check. There's so much kind of spoken about in relation to socially engaged practice around it somehow bettering the self-esteem of the participants, or developing skills, or having an ability to infer benefits. And it may very well be able to do that. But I think it would be wrong to really sort of overstate the capacity to be able to achieve those things. Or I think it would be wrong to kind of overstate the achievement of those things, and to really sort of be very careful about how you speak about the participants, how you describe them, how you talk about them, and how you speak on behalf of them and their experience of taking part in the practice. So, you know, when it comes to talking about the benefits, I think it's really important to actually ask the participants themselves. I think it's also really important to remember that actually the process is the practice. It's not about the photographs that are produced that might get, you know, exhibited or published or circulate, or any other material that you make, but rather it's the process of working with people. It's the relationships you develop with people. And those relationships, they may come to a natural conclusion, but many of those relationships might last for years after the work that you make together, as being the case in my practice. And I think it's really important to remember that you're working with people, you're not working with a practice. I think it's also important to be really open about your intentions, and to be really willing and flexible about adjusting your intentions, to really take on board the feedback from participants, and also to take on board the learning from failure. I don't know what success looks like necessarily, but rather I think that failure is a kind of resource to be drawn upon. Maybe failure is the wrong word, but it's about kind of just learning from the things that perhaps didn't go in the way that you expected or had hoped for. And it's a continual process, I suppose.
Do you think that your background with a minor in writing has influenced a lot of the ways that you think about language and even representation of people visually?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I've always been interested in words and where they come from, what they sound like, what they look like, and how, as much as photographs, they can be inadequate. And, you know, I think the thing about photography is that photography doesn't have the capacity to talk about reality. All it does is has the capacity to tell stories. They're storytelling tools. Photographs are storytelling tools, in as much as words are. And, you know, I can't help but think about the practice of Martha Rosler in relation to your question, and that wonderful work that she made called The Bowery into Inadequate Descriptive Systems, which in many respects does the thing we're talking about here. It kind of points to the fact that a photograph is a concoction that tells a particular kind of story, and as much as language does.
One question also, I think, related to language. You know, you said earlier on about you steer away from the word vulnerable. And I guess I was wondering if you could educate us a little bit on why that is and what is it about the word vulnerable and what alternatives do you use, or can you problematize that for us?
You know, I began to be more mindful of the word vulnerable when I was making a project called Residency in Belfast, which was created between 2006 and 2008. It was through that project that I began to really pay attention to finding ways to represent the process of working with participants. So I began to experiment with video and sound recordings and documenting the work with participants to create their assisted self-portraits. And I began to record conversations, and I was recording a conversation with a woman called Angela Wildman. And she just came out with an extraordinary kind of statement about the word vulnerable, where she said that a lot of people have referred to her as vulnerable, but she doesn't see herself that way. That sure, terrible things have happened to her, but homelessness is an experience, and she will move through it, hopefully, and become stronger for it, or something like that. And I just thought, gosh, how extraordinary to hear someone who the system in which I've met her, the support services, would describe her as vulnerable, but to actually hear that vulnerable person, in quotation marks, describe themselves as not being vulnerable and actually having a kind of very strong reaction to that word being applied to her. It really got me thinking about how we need to be really careful about how we describe people when we talk about them as much as when we make photographs about them or of them. You know, I think that's something that I've really kind of learned, especially through my work with people experiencing homelessness. Even the term homeless people, I mean, there's a huge kind of argument to be made, and one that I fully support, that the term homeless people is obsolete and is terrible, because hopefully for most people, homelessness is an experience and one that a person will move through and shouldn't be the thing that is fixed to them for the rest of their lives. I realise it's an irony in me saying that, given that I'm someone who has a photographic practice which makes images of people experiencing homelessness. But you know, that there are all kinds of ways that language is used, often with the best possible intentions, but can undermine those intentions. So, I think it's really important to be careful about the words that we use, as much as we're careful about the way that we create and disseminate images.
Along the way that you've been developing your collaborative practice, what resources have been useful for you to learn from and to grow from over time?
Yeah, I think there's been a number of resources or influences or material that I found really helpful, you know, ranging from writings and practices of anthropologists and sociologists like Johann Fabian or Norbert Elias, techniques developed by the theatre practitioner Augusto Boal, the social design work of performance artists such as Lois Weaver, and approaches to radical education developed by Paulo Freire, bell hooks and Ivan Illich have all been really important to me over the years. And also, I think the critical writing coming from within photography, writings by Alan Sekula, Martha Rosler, A.D. Coleman, Andy Grunberg, Abigail Solomon-Godot, people who are critically evaluating the power dynamics involved in the creation of photographs of other people, documentary photography and photojournalism in particular, and the way in which those images and practices are used and disseminated, have all been really an important resource that I've drawn upon over the years. And so too has the wealth of practice and writings in the community photography movement here in the UK and other parts of the world in the 1970s and 80s in particular. And much of that kind of history of photography has been kind of excluded or sidelined or just underrepresented in this mainstream histories of photography, despite the fact that the community photography movement and the independent photography had a huge influence on independent photography in the 70s and 80s and contributed to the kind of critical discourse that has really been important for the medium over the past few decades. You know, the publication Camera Work, the publication 10-8, the practices of people such as Andrew Dudney and Martin Lister, Judy Harrison, Paul Carter. There's a wealth of people involved in photography in the 70s and 80s through the community photography movement that contains such important kind of lessons for people working in socially engaged practice today. But there is a disjuncture. As I mentioned, you know, the community photography movement is underrepresented. And I think it is beginning to be addressed. And certainly it's one of the sort of intentions behind the publication that I founded and edit called Photography for Whom, which takes a piece of writing about a practice from the 70s and 80s in the community photography movement in Britain that is underknown about, or perhaps was seen to be significant at the time, but is now underknown about, and also commissions new writing, which looks at the legacy of that practice and connects it to socially engaged practice today. So what I'm trying to do in, I think, Photography for Whom is to provide the kind of resource that I wished was available to me when I began to work in this way. And also to kind of just use this archive of material that I've gathered over the years and to be able to kind of share it with other people too.
Can you tell us, what does photography ethics mean to you?
You know, I think for me, photography ethics, or ethics in general, is a kind of a continual questioning of what is photography, who is it for, am I the best person to be doing what I'm doing with photography? Is this the best possible way to use photography? Are there other ways that we can use photography? And in doing so, what kinds of challenges might that present? I often think about the work of Martha Rosler, or her, the writing of Martha Rosler, as much as her photographic practice. And in particular, a statement that she wrote in her essay, Post-Documentary, Post-Photography, where she speaks about representational responsibility and the kind of responsibility that is incumbent upon a photographer or any kind of cultural producer, really, to really take into consideration the information they convey through their practice and how they go about taking in hand the decisions they make in relation to disseminating the work, in relation to speaking about the work, as well as how the work itself is created and what it depicts. Now, I think it's about really kind of keeping your intentions in check. It's about considering the context in which you disseminate the work. It's about how you create that work. What kind of representations are being put forward? What kind of stories are you telling in the photographs that you create? Because after all, that's what photographs are. They're storytelling devices. And some of those stories will be told in a way that's more mindful of the people depicted than others. I think it's important to be mindful of process as well. The way in which photographs are created is an ethical space. So it's really incumbent upon a photographer, I think, to remember that a photograph isn't just a fraction of a second. The duration of time in the lead up to that fraction of a second is the kind of social dimension of the creation of the image, and one in which the sort of exchange between you and the subject or participant could go in many different courses and directions. And for me, in my practice, it's a space in which I want to try to share the tools that I have available to me in my practice and to see what it is that we can create together. And in doing so, that hopefully the participant will be happy and comfortable with the things that we create. I think that's some of the things that I think about when I think about what photography ethics means to me.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Photo Ethics Podcast. The aim of this podcast is to share new insights about photography ethics with others. So if you heard something you liked, please share this podcast with someone who would appreciate it. The links to all things mentioned in this episode are available in the show notes at www.photoethics.org. Join me next week when we hear from Arpita Shah on representing identity. In each episode of the podcast, we ask our guests, what does photography ethics mean to you? This is a question that everyone in the photography industry should be able to answer. That's why the Photography Ethics Center is asking you, our listeners, to commit to writing and publishing your own statement of ethics. Visit www.photoethics.org/ethics to learn more and to make the pledge committing to ethical transparency, accountability, and awareness. That's www.photoethics.org/ethics. This podcast was edited and digitally produced by Ellie Gascoigne.